Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who chooses to join us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process. And if you choose to listen to those even repeatedly, they can serve as a powerful tutorial to help you get maximum benefits from these tools in the shortest amount of time possible. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I will then be able to turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. If you are unable to call live and or you prefer not to, and you would like to get some comment or feedback or testimonial to us, you can do so by emailing. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question to you from you in email, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred, so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. We are greatly appreciative anytime anybody chooses to do that, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service, and that's just a whole heck of a lot easier to do when we get feedback from people like you about what's landing, what's working, what's not working. So please let us know how we can support you. We have been working through The Way of Mastery again this year, and I believe it was just yesterday that I finished reading through the Lesson 15. And in that lesson, it talks about the only energy that can keep you from having this direct access to what people might call the kingdom, heaven, the bliss state, deep appreciation for the gift of life that is yours in each new present moment. It's called many different things by many different people, but the essence of it is your birthright. This, some people look at life and they say, oh, what a burden. This is so hard. And other people look at life and say, wow, what an amazing gift. It's a miracle that anything is here at all. And this work would fall into that second category. It's amazing that anything is here at all. And as soon as I say that, I think about the Peter Mayer song, Holy Now, and where it says, you know, when I was a kid, it was a real struggle trying to find miracles, and they would talk about them in the Bible. But these days, everything's a miracle. And so this most recent reading that we did in Lesson 15, the entire lesson's about the only thing that can block you from having a delightful experience of life moment to moment is your choice for fear rather than love, your choice for tightness, tension, and constriction rather than awareness of your true nature. And that topic came up in the group last night. And this morning, as I'd mentioned, I'm working my way through the book Awareness by Anthony DeMello yet again. And I was shocked, I was struck by how what I was listening to this morning, almost verbatim what I was saying to group members last night as they were struggling with life situations that they do not prefer. And so I did a little bit of the transcribing from that book, because I'm this go around I'm listening to it on Audible rather than reading it on my Kindle or the paperback that I have. But the essence of Lesson 15 is telling us the only thing that blocks you from having an instant, constant, blissful state in life, regardless of the outside events, is your choice to believe that your fearful thoughts are true rather than believing in or observing directly the miracle of life expressing in, through, as, and around you. And then Anthony DeMello was saying, anytime you have negative feelings towards anyone, you're living in an illusion. His next words are powerful. There's something seriously wrong with you. as you discovered, you're not seeing capital R reality. Something inside of you has to change. But what do we generally do when we have a negative feeling? We say, she's to blame, or he's to blame, or she has to change. Oh, no, no, no. The world is all right. The one who has to change is you. The I feels threatened. But the quote I, close quote, your essence is never threatened. It's only the thoughts about yourself that we call me that is threatened. He goes on and says, now, did you assume that I was saying that you wouldn't do anything? I said you wouldn't have negative feelings, as a result of which you would be much, much more effective. Because when the negative feelings come in, you go blind. The quote, me, close quote, steps into the picture and everything gets fouled up. And frequently, when we had a problem on our hands, now we have two problems. You might assume that not having negative feelings of anger or hate would mean that you do nothing about a situation. Oh, no. You're not emotionally affected, but you are actionally affected, if that makes any sense. You spring into action. You become very sensitive to things and people around you. What kills the sensitivity is this, what many would call the, quote, conditioned self, close quotes. When you identify with your thoughts about yourself, the, quote, me, close quotes, there's too much of you in it for you to see things objectively or to see things detachedly. That is the only way to see things as close to accurately as possible, to be detached from the thoughts of yourself, to be living in the direct observation, to be understanding that any time I have a negative thought or emotion in my mind, whatever my mind is telling me in that moment is a lie. This is tough stuff for most of us raised in the Western world. This goes against everything we've been taught. And because of what we've been taught and internalized, it goes against most everything we've experienced. Most people have never had an experience of just watching and observing life and responding. Most people live their lives from the belief systems that they were indoctrinated into. And they don't even have any sense of what it might be like to live a life from direct observation, to live a life in the deep appreciation for the gift of life itself without all of the judging, without all of the distortions of perception. And yet that's what we're being invited into in this work time after time, lesson after lesson. I get it. I was there once. I was first introduced to this, and somebody said, hey, whenever you're upset, it means your mind is lying to you. And I thought, well, that's the dumbest thing ever. How am I supposed to know what's right and what's wrong and, you know, who the good guys are and who I should be fighting and how I can help make the world a better place if I don't make these judgments and if I don't get upset? So I understand firsthand how difficult an adjustment it can be to make the choice to live from direct observation and question every belief, not just the ones that, you know, don't seem to make sense. Question every belief. because it's only in that space where I'm actively questioning that I'm actually open to seeing the capital T truth of life and or learning something new. I cannot possibly learn something new when I'm operating from my belief system. And, you know, it's fascinating how thoroughly entrenched our minds are into this, how thoroughly conditioned we are into this. Last night in the support group, I was talking about these very things, and as soon as I finished, one of the group members said, "I believe you, Dr. Tim." And I just had a chuckle. It was like the whole last 5 minutes I'd been talking was about questioning every belief, and the first response out of this person's mouth was, "I believe you." And then I had to take a few minutes to just slow down and say, please don't believe me. Please question everything I say and everything you think and everything you've been taught. Because unless I'm actively in that space of questioning, I have blinders on. I've identified with something. I'm doing what Anthony DiMello was talking about here. I'm putting the me in place of the I, and I'm thinking that the I is vulnerable because really the only thing that's vulnerable in me is my thoughts about me. It is a very, very different way to look at things and proceed in life, which if you know anything about how life works, that's a good thing, because if I keep doing the same thing over and over again and I don't like the results I'm getting, I'm dooming myself to just keep reliving the same life. I can't possibly hope to have any change if I just keep doing the same thing I've always done. You know, we need to wake up. What does it mean to wake up? It means to question everything. It means to learn to live in the direct observation that, you know, we would be trying to live in if we lived out in the jungle and there were lots of poisonous plants and poisonous animals and, you know, ways to get hurt. And we wouldn't want to be living by belief in that situation. We'd want to be living as much as possible by direct observation. Moment to moment, wide awake. What's around us? Where are we headed? What are the animals and plants that are closest to us that have a chance to impact us positively or negatively? Hopefully, the way we would drive a car on our best day, wide awake. Paying very clear attention to the road around us, to the environment we're driving through. The invitation in this work is to live your life that way. The invitation in this work is to wake up to how often we aren't living our life that way. Wake up to how often we're living our lives basically in a trance state. We're living from expectation rather than from observation. And if you have, you know, if you want to have any kind of evidence that living from expectation and belief is counterproductive, just look at the wars on the planet. Just look at the road rage incidents. Just look at the rate of relationships that end in, or should end because they're so abusive and they don't. Or they end in, you know, long held feuds, rather than just the recognition that, well, it's time to move on and, you know, create a lifestyle that we prefer with somebody else who has, you know, a matching set of goals in life and a matching set of values and priorities, because perhaps those values, priorities, and goals in life of our partner have changed. Rather than doing that with grace and peace, if we're living from the belief that we should never end a relationship, and every time a relationship is threatened to end, it means somebody else is bad or wrong and they need to be attacked and punished or worse, that's living from belief. And the evidence of how unproductive that is all around us. All we have to do is wake up and see it. Wake up and be in the moment observing it. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll be able to turn on your microphone, and we can have a conversation. As I mentioned, that I'm going through the Anthony DeMello book, Awareness, again. I'm struck by how I was called to start listening to that again and how in alignment it is with Lesson 13 and 14 and 15 in the Way of Mastery, this that we just finished reading. The whole idea about waking up to what it is we actually value and what we're pouring our mind energy into. And he has a section in the book where he talks about what is waking up. Spirituality means waking up. Most people, even though they don't know it, are asleep. Well, that's what the Way of Mastery is trying to call us to. Most of us are walking around valuing things that we say we don't value, but we're actually valuing them because that's where we pour our mind energy. We pour our mind energy into thoughts of anger and bitterness and hurt and resentment and victimhood, and yet we say that we value love and we value spirituality. But Anthony DeMello says most people are born asleep and they stay asleep. They marry in their sleep. They breed children in their sleep. They die in their sleep without ever waking up. They never understand the loveliness and the beauty of this thing that we call human existence. You know, all mystics, Catholic, Christian, non-Christian, no matter what their ideology, no matter what their religion, they are all unanimous on one thing. And that is that the bottom line is all is well. All is well. That everything is a mess. And all is well. It's a strange paradox, to be sure, but tragically, most people never get to see that all is well because they're asleep. They are having a nightmare. He goes on and tells a story about how last year on Spanish television, he heard a story about a gentleman who knocks on his son's door. Jamie, he says, wake up. And Jamie answers, I don't want to get up, Papa. And the father shouts, get up, you have to go to school. And Jamie says, I don't want to go to school. The father asks, why not? Three reasons, says Jamie. First, because it's so dull. Second, the kids tease me. And third, I hate school. And the father says, well, I'm going to give you three reasons why you must go to school. First, it's because it's your duty. Second is because you're 45 years old. And third is because you're the headmaster. Wake up. You're grown up. You're too big to be asleep. Wake up. Stop playing with your toys. Most people tell you they want to get out of kindergarten, but don't believe them. All they want to do is to mend their broken toys. Give me back my life. Give me back my job. Give me back my money. Give me back my reputation and my success. This is what they want. That's all. They want their toys to be replaced. Even the best psychologists will tell you that people don't really want to be cured. What they want is relief. At another point in the book, Anthony DeMello says, there's a story about a man in a third world country riding on a bus, and he's carrying a package, a big heavy package on his lap. And the bus attendant comes back and says, well, you know, what's that on your lap? And the guy says, it's a bomb. And the attendant says, it's a bomb? You don't want to be riding with a bomb on your lap. He says, put that under your seat. And Anthony DeMello says, that's basically what most psychologists do these days. They help people hide their problems. They don't help people see to the root of them and dismantle their problems. In order to do that, in order to see to the root of my problem, I have to be willing to see that I'm the cause. It's like what Guy Finley says in one of his talks. He says, your mind will just keep doing what it always automatically does, even though what your mind is doing is causing the pain that you're feeling. But your mind is not going to stop doing that until your mind wakes up and sees that it is the source of your pain, not the solution to your pain. It happens automatically, but only when it's seen clearly, all the way to the root. And I can't see clearly all the way to the root when I'm asleep or when I'm living from belief rather than direct observation. Anytime I believe I have any kind of pain, any kind of a negative thought about myself or somebody else, any kind of a negative emotion in my life, in my mind, body, energy system, and I believe what my mind is telling me, I'm off the mark. Because in the moment when my mind is generating a negative emotion or a negative thought about myself or somebody else, it is lying to me. It's telling me something that is not true and therefore not useful. Only the truth is useful. Only the truth can set you free. As I said last night in the group, as I was making that very observation, we got quite a bit of questioning and pushback. And I understand it because it's the opposite of everything I was taught as I went to school. And I went to a school, a high school. My parents were willing to sacrifice enough to send us to a school that would prepare us for college, just in case we wanted to go. And all of that schooling from kindergarten, grade school, high school, and college was all focused on the conscious logical mind as the repository for all the solutions we're ever going to need. All of that education was focused on living from the intellect, not what Way of Mastery would call the awakened heart. And as the discussion in the support group last night kept coming back to, there are very few of us, as we're looking at our day-to-day problems, who have any experience in just tuning into the awakened heart. We keep getting stuck spinning in the intellect and the conscious logical mind trying to figure it out. What's the solution to this situation that I call a problem? How can I get something different in my life than what I've already got? And because of that, we spin. We spin constantly, and some would say we spin endlessly. how can we move from spinning into something productive, something that will give us an opportunity for difference, for a different experience of life. The Way of Mastery says you have to put aside the intellect. You have to understand it'll always be there as a useful tool. And yet, it shouldn't be your primary user interface for you in life with other people, with your day-to-day interactions with life. The primary user interface should be the awakened heart. It should be your emotional energy system as your guidance tool. And over and over again, the Way of Mastery is asking us to step into the use of these exercises and the use of these observations to move from the head, from the intellect, into the heart space. And it warns us, or it tells us very directly, that if we keep moving forward in our life with our intellect, without stopping to practice a different way to interact with the world, we're not going to move forward in our lives. We're not going to wake up. We're not going to align with our Creator. We're not going to be able to tap into and access greater levels of creativity and expansion and joy if we don't wake up to the fact that our minds, our intellectual minds, are what's creating. Guy Finley says, yeah, the misuse, the misdirected use of your conscious logical thought process is directly responsible for the vast majority of your mental and emotional pain and suffering. So Guy Finley has the same message. You know, I was just reading from Anthony DeMello's book where he said, if you have any negative feelings towards anyone, you're living in an illusion, and there's something seriously wrong with you. You're not seeing reality. Something inside of you has to change, but our culture has taught us to go out and change other people and to yell at them and blame them and tell them they have to change. But Anthony DeMello says, no, the world is all right. The one who has to change is you. Well, Guy Finley says, anytime you're having a physical, mental, or emotional upset, it's from the misuse of your mind energy. And then what happens? David Bohm says, we misuse our mind energy to create our upset, and then we decide to double down and use more of our mind energy to figure out how. I had a stellar example in my office last night. I had a woman who's in her 50s who is an emergency room medical doctor, highly, highly proficient. And she's talking to me about a woman she knows who, and by her description, this woman is beautiful and she is a pediatric neurologist, and, you know, very, very sought after in her job. And the pediatric neurologist is ruining every relationship she has. Now, the woman in front of me is an emergency room physician who is attractive in her own right. You know, pleasant-looking face, well-proportioned body, plenty of money, et cetera, et cetera. And she doesn't think that she's valuable unless she's perfect. Both of these women continually resort to their conscious logical mind to try and sort out the problems in their emotional life and their relationships, and they're spiraling down into what, you know, most people would call hell, because they're stuck doing the same thing over and over again, and they haven't had the opportunity yet. They haven't been exposed to the idea that the only way out of this model is to quit using the very tools they're using that they think they have to use to find resolution. They've got to start engaging in something that takes them, as Michael Rice would say, out of their mind. Now, the reality management worksheet process offers us the opportunity to do that every time we cancel a goal and ask to be shown something else. There are other tools. There's Byron Katie's worksheet process that has us, whether they realize it or not, bypassing the conscious logical mind and questioning everything it wants to tell us, because she understands people only suffer when they believe their negative thoughts. They don't really suffer from their negative thoughts. They only suffer when they believe their negative thoughts. So her process has people questioning all of this stuff that they believe at the conscious logical level. Diedrich Wolzak has a six-step worksheet process based on his work with The Course in Miracles. It has, as its core, a very similar process of dismantling what we believe is true and using what is generated in our emotional state as a keyway or a pathway to find where is the false belief about ourselves that we're holding on to, that we've downloaded from some earlier experience in life, and then seeing it as false and dismantling it. But again, it's the same core process as understanding that if I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else, or a negative emotion that's active in my mind, I can instantly know it's false. If I had $100 for every person that I have seen in the therapy office in the past 50 years who was attractive by societal standards, who was decidedly above average intelligence, who was successful by societal standards, and who did not like themselves and or thought they were unlovable, I could have retired at 20 years in the business, could have retired 30 years ago. How is that possible? Because so many of us think that the thing that would make us happy is if we were more attractive, or if we were smarter, or if we had a better job, or if we had more money. And yet, time and again, the people who have all those things are not happy. As a matter of fact, many of them are downright miserable. How is that possible? I think the only way it's possible is because of the truth that we cannot solve a problem at the level of mind that it was created. And I can't solve a problem at an emotional level, at a spiritual or emotional level, with my intellectual mind. Can't happen. So our caller number is 563-999-3581. I'm slowing down in the reading of The Way of Mastery specifically to give us a chance to let this simmer to let ourselves explore. How much are we actually applying the questioning that the Way of Mastery asks us to apply? How much are we waking up to the things we actually value? How much are we willing to see that the tools we thought were going to be our salvation are literally the source of our pain? If we're asleep, if we're not willing to wake up, we just keep repeating the same stuff and blaming our outside circumstances or the people around us. You know, Guy Finley, last night in the support group, we went back to an older Guy Finley talk from dozens and dozens of years ago. He has a CD set titled Steps to Oneness, and it's got 8 different CDs, about an hour each. And we listened to one that has the story of Pleasant Valley and the woman who was living in Pleasant Valley. And she woke up one day and she realized that she wasn't satisfied with her life and that things in Pleasant Valley weren't as pleasant as they were made out to be. And so she decided she was going to leave Pleasant Valley. And so she made a big mistake. She went and told her friend she was leaving. Now, by a mistake, we just mean that she did something that was off the mark. She did something that wasn't actually going to help her leave. It all works out in the end. All these stories are all spiritual stories. It's all an interior story. Every person and every aspect of the dream is contained within the story is contained in the person that we're telling the story about. You and I, every one of us, have parts of us that want a change, and we have parts of us that don't want a change. So when this woman told her friends that she was going to leave, they said, oh no, don't leave. We don't want you to go. We want you to stay here. And oh, by the way, you can't leave because Pleasant Valley has guards. And the prime character in the story said, what guards? I've never seen any guards. You got to be kidding me. There's no guards. And then, as most people of a certain mind, when they're told they can't do something, it strengthens their resolve to go ahead and do it. So now that her friends told her you can't leave because there's guards, she says, I'm leaving. And so she heads out, packs up her stuff, and she heads out hiking out of Pleasant Valley. And she's gone for, you know, a couple hours, and all of a sudden she sees off in the distance, maybe half a mile away, somebody walking towards her, which is weird because she's out in the middle of nowhere and there shouldn't be anybody there. But her friend had already told her that there's guards, and she's wondering, well, what are these one of those guards? And they're coming to block me. So she says, okay, I'll take a different path. So she takes a different path. She takes a left, and she heads in a completely different direction. And she's hiking for another hour or so, and then she sees somebody in the distance coming at her. And now this is beginning to freak her out because she changed directions. This can't be the same person she saw before, but it looks like they're basically the same size and shape. And so, you know, she does what most of us do when we're faced with difficulties like that. She goes home and takes a nap. And a couple years later, she wakes up again and realizes, oh, wait a minute, I wanted to leave Pleasant Valley. And so she goes to leave Pleasant Valley again. And the cycle repeats. And eventually, she's confronted with a person everywhere she tries to walk, and so she has to screw up her courage and keep walking. And the closer she gets to this person, the more she thinks, oh my God, this person looks a lot like me. This could be my twin. And time after time, as she gets closer and sees it's somebody that looks almost exactly like her, she turns around and retreats to home and, you know, buys a cupcake or whatever we do to distract ourselves, until eventually she decides, this is it, I can't do this anymore. I need a change. So she strikes out, and she's out in a wooded area that she's never tried to go out before, and she's going to leave Pleasant Valley. And lo and behold, this person confronts her again. And it's really scary. How does this person know where I am and where I'm going to be? And so this time she fortifies herself, and she marches forward, and sure enough, this person is, the closer this person gets, the more it looks exactly like her. And as she gets closer, she realizes, oh my gosh, it's not a person, it's a mirror. And that freaks her out, because where did that mirror come from? And how come it's where she wants to be, to leave Pleasant Valley? And eventually she gets close to the mirror and touches it, and her finger goes through the mirror. And that just absolutely freaks her out, and she goes running back home again. Another couple of years later, she realizes that she was going to leave, and she should leave, and every time she strikes out, the mirror is closer, and she runs away from it. Until one day, she goes to leave. Now, she's done all of the tricks, right? Like, how do you outwit the mirror? Tell your friends that you're staying forever, and you're going to buy a new home, and then you try and leave. Or you tell your friends, oh, by the way, I'm just going out to the store, and, you know, and leave, and the mirror is there. One day she opens the door, and the mirror is in the doorway. And after the terror and after the freak out, she realizes that she either stays in her house and never leaves, or she's got to find a way past this mirror. And she touches it again, and her hand goes into it. And then she gets all of her courage up, and she steps right into and through the mirror, like one of those sci-fi liquid things where it just kind of melts away. And what happened is she stepped through the mirror and she stepped right into all of her terror, and she found herself outside Pleasant Valley. Blink of an eye. No walking needed. We have to wake up to the fact that that which we are doing within ourselves that keeps us from the bliss state is the only thing that keeps us from the bliss state. The outside events are not keeping us from the bliss state. Lesson 15 from yesterday, as we were reading, the entire lesson 15 is all about how the only energy that can separate you from your kingdom, the kingdom, love, bliss, joy, the only energy that can keep you from experiencing the bliss state all day, every day, is your choice to value fear over love. In any given moment. The only thing that keeps you stuck in Pleasant Valley is you. The only thing that keeps you sad, angry, scared, or hurt is you. The only thing that keeps you from being able to apply these tools and these observations is your willingness or lack of willingness. We don't even listen to these lessons with an open mind and open heart. We're listening to most of these lessons and spiritual teachers from our biases. That's why we were talking last week about listening techniques that have us starting from scratch and questioning everything and listening with an eye toward being able to understand the other person's position. We talked about Robert Bolton's people skills and Dr. Michael Rice's responsibility communication tool and Harville Hendricks' Imago Dialogue. And Anthony DeMello talks about that in his book Awareness. He says, look, we're brainwashed. And an idea, you know, how can you tell that you've been brainwashed is if you want to argue for something and you want to die for an idea. Any test of whether or not you've been brainwashed is if you get upset when someone challenges one of your ideas. He says, there's this girl who's listening to a lecture on agriculture, and she says, excuse me, sir, you know, I agree with you completely that the best manure is aged horse manure. Now, would you tell us how old the horse should be? You see where she's coming from? She thinks she's listening, but she's not. Here's a woman. She walks in. She sees a guy. Oh, Henry, you've changed. You were so tall, and you've grown so short. You were so well built, and now you've grown so thin. You were so fair, and you've become so dark. Henry, what's happened to you? And the man says, I'm not Henry. I'm John. And the woman says, oh, you changed your name, too. How do you get people like that to listen? The most difficult thing in the world is to open up and listen to things that go against what you believe in, what you've been brainwashed into. The one thing that most of us need is the readiness to learn something new. We don't need youthfulness, we don't need energy, we don't need great intelligence. We need the willingness, the readiness to learn something new. The chances that you will wake up are in direct proportion to the amount of truth you can take without running away. If your first reaction is fear, you are not open to learning. You're never afraid of the unknown. You can't be afraid of something you don't know. Nobody's afraid of the unknown. What they really fear is the loss of what they already know and what they believe in. So just like Guy Finley says, the same kind of thing. He said, the lessons that we need to learn in life come into our life on the back of the events that we do not want. And the degree to which we do not want, the more we don't want an event, the more important the lesson is in that event. Because life is just this flow of energy. And that's why in Way of Mastery it says in Lesson 3, we create the veils that keep us from seeing life as it truly is, to see it as love, to see it as the extension of the creative energy and form. And we do that by judgment. And we do that by creating our perception. And we do that by clinging to what we think is right and ignoring the warning signs of our energy system, our emotional guidance system, telling us that we're feeling tight or tense or upset. And rather than reading that as an indication that we are somehow off the mark, we've been trained to start believing that the world is off the mark. How could the world be off the mark? How could the flow of creation, as it's expressing and expanding, be bad or wrong? And how could a mind, like the conscious logical mind in a human being, that has trouble staying awake in a lecture, that has trouble paying attention, that has trouble putting down a smartphone and quitting scrolling some social media, how could that mind know what's right or wrong in the flow of life? It can't. There's just no way possible for the conscious, logical mind of a human being to even comprehend, much less, even if it were being taught, it can't comprehend the flow of life, much less know enough to initiate it or govern it by itself. So we are called time and again by these great teachings to learn to turn the focus inside of ourselves, to spend more of our conscious, logical mind energy monitoring ourselves for our own internal guidance system. And the way they talk about it in Jesus' autobiography, where he talks about how our emotions are our guidance system. And if we have an emotion that's calm and joyful and pleasant and gratitude-based, we're probably headed in the right direction with our thoughts and our actions. But if we have any kind of an emotion that leaves us feeling tight or tense or unpleasant in any way, that's the indication that we are off the mark with our energies. That's why Dr. Michael Rice has it in the worksheet process. It says in the seven-step worksheet process, if I'm in pain, my thinking is in error. And anything I do with my thinking when I'm still in pain is in error. If I can wake up to that, if I can listen to my own alarm system, my own guidance system, I can be ready to ask to be shown something else, and I can be shown the way to a better life. But if I'm not willing to ask, if I'm not willing to recognize that my pain, my fear, my sadness is the indication that I'm in error with my thoughts, I keep arguing for my thoughts. You know, the old adage, you argue for your limitations, and they are yours. That's our show for the first hour. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. I'll turn on the microphone for and welcome Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tian. I appreciate it.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thanks. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Wednesday, March the 27th, 2024. And our calling number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. And I'll put it in the notes for today, but you can also go on the website and click under schedule. You can see it under flyers and publicity, or you can see it just listed under schedule, Women Healing Women Intensive. And so several ladies have asked me to do this, so here you go, and then I will do it. Pre-registration is required. It's going to be the last week of September and the first week of October. Now, I know that when we've done previous online intensives, we have stretched it out like 10 weeks or 14 weeks or whatever, just 3 or 4 hours a week. But what I am going to do, and I know it's intense, it's going to be intense for me too. I guess that's why they call it an intensive. It's going to be for 2 weeks, and we'll do Saturday and Sunday, 3 hours, both of those days, and then an hour and a half to 2 hours each evening during the week. So it's going to be a total of 32 hours. And anyway, the information, all the details, what it covers, and what comes with it is all on the website under schedules and under Women Healing Women Intensive. And so if you are ready to make a commitment to do that, that's several months out. And what I'm doing, just as a way of explanation, is that our next grandchild will have been born by then, Lincoln. And so right after, he's only going to be like 3 or 4 weeks old, but they are planning, Ryan and Gabby and Aria and Lincoln are going to go on a two-week vacation. So that's going to free up 2 weeks of time can devote for preparing and teaching and doing all those things. So I am squishing it into 2 weeks. You know, stretching it out for 10 weeks or whatever afterwards, it's going to be, you know, with two babies here, Lincoln and Aria. For me, that would just be a challenge. So if you're willing to put those hours in, it's just 2 weeks and you can do it. So anyway, I need you to commit to it so I can firm it up. The last week of September, first week of October. And like I said, all the information is online under schedule and under Women Healing Women. So that's what I have to offer, and I'm going to welcome Michael.
What an awesome opportunity. I can remember many years ago I was in a Native American camp, and they were doing a women's sweat, and I questioned the discrimination aspect of excluding men, and they actually let me go into the sweat. And it was an interesting space, an interesting time. So this, I would like to be a fly on the wall, and maybe for some, but I will be able to be, but that'll be awesome, sweetie. I'll look forward to seeing that unfold and the transformation it'll make for you in you as well as in everybody who chooses to attend. So that's pretty exciting. Congratulations. And do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
Nobody has a hand up and nothing's going on in the chat room. Let me flip over. I think we have answered all the questions that I have received by email. Let me just double check real quick. Yes, I don't have any out there that we have not addressed.
Cool.
So, okay. So maybe you can get back to the enlightenment.
Yeah, let's go back to enlightenment. And as we had said earlier, there are several words which were left in what Dan McDougall chose to call their original dignity in the Aramaic language, rather than trying to find a word in English that would substitute, because the concepts are so different in Aramaic that people who've substituted certain words for Aramaic words don't even come close. So Ruka Dekutcha is the next one I'd like to talk about. And so that one was left in the original Aramaic. And if you're following us in the book, I'm on page 92. So we're looking at the concept of calling on Ruka Dekutcha. These are the words that the Greeks translated as the Holy Spirit. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with a disembodied spirit being. But it actually talks about a feminine elemental force in us that, and this is kind of my short form of it, that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. So Ruka being a word in Aramaic that represents the elemental forces, you know, the element of earth, air, fire, water, Ruka is a fifth force. And the Dekutcha aspect relates to the word kosher in Aramaic, which means that which is proper, in this case for humans. So Ruka Dekutcha, usually translated as the Holy Spirit, not because it's the literal meaning is not available, but because of the degree of confusion on the concept illustrated. The sound triggers the action part of Alaha. So Alaha is the word that represents the Creator, and Ruka Dekutcha speaks of the aspect of the Creator that moves in the world. And must be worshipped, according to John 23:24. Worship means emulated. What's the energy that you need to emulate to be in resonance? You know, when two energy fields are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an exchange of energy between them. What do we need to be reached to in order to become a receiver for that energy of Ruka Dekutcha? It is the quote-unquote Parakleta, which literally means she who breaks off the effects of errors and teaches the truth, and is to be awesome, all-embracingly cherished and trusted. And then there's a quote from John 14:26, "For she who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit is Ruka Dikudsha. She, my Abi, Abi being father, will send through me. She will instruct you in all matters, and she will remind you all that I have said of you." If I want the energy of, let's say, 900 on my radio dial to come into my radio and become available to me through the speakers, what do I have to do? I have to tune my radio dial to 900. I can't be on 1350 and expect to listen to 900. And so there is an energetic pattern that emanates from the Creator that's called love. How am I going to receive the information from that? And if my mind is so dull to the presence of love, am I going to be able to hear its guidance or its direction? Am I going to benefit from the energy that will enter me if I don't make an effort to attune to it? And I would say that would be more in alignment with that idea of worship. So Ruka Dikudsha is a feminine word, and the pronoun she was normally used to refer to her until the time of Constantine, when the church was massively reconfigured to support the imperial agenda of oppression and patriarchal superiority and control. The beauty and effectiveness of Ruka Dikudsha is testified to by the very fact that while Constantine tried to pervert the church beyond recognition to oppress his people, and remember that Yeshua is the man that's called the Prince of Peace. He speaks about, you know, the goal being to live in serenity, in alignment with love, whose source is love, whose father is love. And here's this guy who is out on the battlefield killing people one day and swears that he sees a cross with Yeshua on it, and therefore he's going to make his war plans Christian. It's like, what kind of transmutation is that? So with time, Ruka brought the church into triumph over oppression. Ancient symbolic pictures from Egypt, South America, and elsewhere depict the use or action of four elemental forces in the creation of the universe. Humanity augmenting its senses with all manner of devices has, as yet, been unable to sense or perceive any of these four forces. These forces are said to have been used with the action of Ruka Dikudsha to create the physical universe and life. For instance, it is well known that the stars are expanding outward at tremendous velocities from a central point of beginning, despite billions of years of gravitational attraction posing their outward rush. Some immense originating expulsive force was needed to initiate their outward journey. Humanity's created mind, using creative devices, has been unable to sense such uncreated but creative force. But we can observe by the fact that it exists, that it is there. And I'm just looking. I've got some marks on here as though we had already covered this. Let me just look here. Yes, I think we have covered this. I think we talked about this 2 weeks ago. So we'll just go to the conclusion of this section on Ruka Dikudsha. It now becomes a review. Let's go to the last paragraph or two on page 93 of that section. As Ruka Dikudsha represents Allah's, the creative forces, immeasurable force upon the mind of humanity and creation, a fourth force which humanity can receive into its nafsha, but cannot be perceived. The mind's not going to be able to generate direct information about this elemental force any more than it can create or it can directly sense what the wind is. The example that Yeshua used when he was talking about this force to one of the elders of the, of the, the Jewish faith, that had no clue what he was talking about. He says, what, you don't know? And then he uses the example of the wind. Well, you know by its effect it's been here, even though you can't see it directly, and so it is with Ruka, or I usually short form it to Ruka. And sometimes you'll notice in the book it's spelled R-O-O-K-H-A. The foundation's gone through a couple of permutations, and sometimes it's spelled R-U-K-H-A. So the Aramaic symbol Kudsha is the Aramaic ancestor of the Hebrew word kosher. And while kosher means proper as delineated by the five books of Moses, Kudsha is broader and means proper as determined by and in harmony with the laws of the oneness for humanity, whether known or unknown. It represents that which is divinely intended for humanity. The Kudsha, Ruka the Kudsha, has many distinct but cooperative aspects which initiate a variety of actions. The actions are not Ruka the Kudsha, but rather a result of Ruka the Kudsha. These actions include life and communication from Alaha to human intelligence. This latter action correlates with Carl Jung's universal conscience. Jung describes this as an all-pervasive web of interconnectedness between the divine and the worldly. Ruka the Kudsha functions as a transmitter and communicator of Allah's laws for humanity. John 14:26, she will instruct you in all matters, and she will bring to your minds that which I have said to you. You know, I think we could safely assume that Albert Einstein, when he said, if you think you're separate or separated from the rest of humanity, he may have been attuned with and had that input because of his ability to attune to Ruka the Kudsha, and likely this place where he brought his higher levels of understanding that's prior to Einstein showing up with his mind, or, well, it just, you know, there was nothing that even came close. So you'll notice that in the step 6B, or pardon me, 5B of the worksheet, you know, the first part of the worksheet is placed to describe the construct of your mind, your perception. And then it moves into determining what is it, what's the goal that drives your perception. Then asking that love be present in you as you collapse the perception by canceling the goal that drives it. And then in 5B, there's a request. And when you think in terms of the generational patterns that we can tend to be stuck in, if I, you know, I had mentioned yesterday, see, we all have known about their, or heard of, or perhaps directly observed the young man who never knew anything about his father. His father was dead before he was ever born, and yet mannerisms, ways of speaking, right down to the way he held his face, showed up. It speaks of energetic patterns that go way beyond anything our senses can be aware of. And this indicates that there is an elemental force in us that can reach into that depth when relied on, when requested to assist. And like the wind, if you've never been out in it and somebody talks about the wind, you're going to go, well, what is that? Once you go out, you're going to have an experience of the effect of the wind. One who's never stopped to become aware of this elemental force in their lives or asked for support or assistance is going to be like someone who's lived their whole lives indoors. You speak of the wind, and what does it mean? What you'll notice as you do the worksheet process and invite that elemental force into activity is that there is a power in you that can reach so deeply into your family history, into your cultural history, so as to be able to undo those energetic patterns that come from being off base, off the mark in one's life. And so the idea of that step, and another way to understand Ruka Dikuchu when it comes to, gee, if I've got something that goes back 10 generations in my bloodline, how do I reach in? How do I undo that? So we could say in our more modern computer language, there is a super processor in us. We've got free will. It's never going to interfere with our free will. But when we're willing to work through something that perhaps is so big we can hardly fathom it, then what you do is you turn it over to Ruka Dikuchu. What does it sound like when you turn something over to Ruka Dikuchu? Here's what it sounds like. It is the breath. That's why so often you'll hear me as we're processing with someone, and I can sense the level of trauma that they're in. I'll ask the question, what's happening with your breath? And most of the time, there'll be a little bit of a nervous laugh, and it's like, well, I wasn't breathing, or I'd radically altered my breathing pattern. When we withhold the breath from our physiology, we literally lock energy into tissues that do not belong, into tissue that does not belong in tissue. And so you'll notice on the worksheet at several germane points where people are likely to hold their breath, there is the reminder to breathe. That's how it's turned over. Yes, there is a mental process of inviting, of asking for support. But if you ask for that support and you're not breathing, you're not likely to get much. And so there is this feminine, you know, if I look at any given construct in my mind, let's say a construct that's based in some sort of fear or terror or rage or vengeance or what have you, in order to produce a construct as seemingly solid and massive as some people get trapped in, it takes a huge quantity of underlying energy, like huge, beyond what we could fathom. How do I handle that quantity or that level of energy? Within you, literally, there is a superprocessor that when you allow your breath to move through your physiology, if there's something relative to this forgiveness process that you're engaged in that needs to be accessed, this elemental force can access it. And, you know, ultimately, it's the core of our still point breathing process and one of the most important tools that we teach. And, you know, the still point breathing process is something that I discovered about 42, 43 years ago, something in that range. And over the years, I've breathed thousands of people. And it doesn't matter what the trauma is that someone is experiencing. If they will turn it over fully to the breath will handle it. It is the super processor. And that's why you'll hear me over and over remind people to breathe. Or if somebody, you know, challenges, brings something up for me, you'll hear me say, well, let me take a breath on that one. It is the prime mover within physiology. And you watch people when they're in trauma and they withhold their breath. And when you restore your breath fully to whatever the trauma energy is in you, and we could relate that to the Aramaic word sin, which is an archery term, which means off the mark. When you can take any energy that is off the mark in your physiology, and if you put an energy into your physiology that's off the mark, there's going to be pain. When you restore that energy to the breath, any pained aspect of it dissolves and dissipates. Hence, we have this feminine elemental force that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. Pretty profound to have that opportunity to the Aramaic and really understand what this man Yeshua was talking about when he spoke of this, and then to take it a step further and going into the Aramaic and recognize that it's not speaking about some, again, disembodied spirit creature, but it's rather speaking about your own breath. When you go, if you go back to the creation story in Aramaic, it doesn't say that the Creator sent out its spirit. As the Greeks would tell us, it says the Creator sent out its breath. It's our direct link. It's our direct connection to the Creator. And that's why whatever you hold in you, whatever you need to work through, I'm going to invite you to step up to the plate and ask that elemental force to move in you and be willing to turn it over. Turning over of it is how you let loose of it. There is no trauma in human experience that if exposed to the breath will not dissolve. Just the way it works. So I hope that makes sense for everybody. And I'll just check in, Miss Jenny. Is there anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anyone who has any thoughts or questions about that?
Unmute here.
Yay.
Yay. So there is a hand up, and I believe that it is Peter. 619, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, welcome, good sir. How do you be?
Great. Good morning. I had a question about something we had talked about before.
Uh-huh.
That as you go through the worksheets, you're changing the energy inside of you, and then you're required to have a level of vitality to deal with it, because when the negative energy is released, it's a painful process. Yes?
Well,
no?
It can be. My offering would be that if there's something, and we can relate this to the breath, to Rukha Dukkha, if there's something painful that I access and I withdraw my breath, I'm holding my breath, I'm trying to avoid it, I'm trying to shut it down, I can prolong the pain of that. If my experience has been, and I've watched hundreds and hundreds of people with like major, horrific traumas, and if they'll just fully restore the breath to that, that stuff can move in a fraction, in an instant. It's when literally the system is in a resistant state. In Aramaic, if you remember, the resistor is the definition of the word Satan. In Aramaic, Satan is not some dude with a red suit, a tail, and a pitchfork. It's the resistor, one who misleads. And as long as somebody's holding on to the story their mind has to cover up their denial, cover up what they've dissociated from, then their pain and trauma is going to be reflected and stretched out. But if one is willing to just breathe into and through that, then what I've observed is it dissipates and disappears that fast. But we can prolong it if we resist and fight against it. Literally, I look back into my early training in physics and electronics, and what I see is literally when I'm in holding my breath, I create a literal resistor out of my tissue. And what a resistor does in a piece of electronic equipment is resist the flow of energy through it, cuts back the flow of energy through it. And to the degree that you cut it back, there's a direct relationship to how long it's going to move. If I allow myself to fully surrender to the breath, literally, physiologically, I go into a superconductor state. Now, it's not going to be easy to go into a superconductor state if what I do is eat all the junk food in the world, I, you know, sip energy drinks all day, and then I do a fifth of scotch at night, not going to be too easy to get into that superconductor state, because physiologically my energy is going to be depleted. And, you know, I think we've shared before the idea of, you know, if I'm at a level 5 vitality and I have a level 7 toxin in me, I can say to myself, oh, I want to work through this issue. I want to work through this issue. Rukka, help me work through this issue. But am I going to, you know, move into a decent dietary regimen? No, I want my Cokes and I want my, you know, butterscotch sundaes and I want my Doritos and I want my, you know, Cheetos. Junk oil, sugar, salt, everything that man has conceived of to drag down the vitality of a human being. So by doing that, I add to my resistance. So if I have this level 7 toxin and it were to break loose in me, literally, it could physically kill me, the toxic release from that. So I'm not going to tend to see that level 7. I'm not going to work through I'll come back around to it, come back around to it, come back around. I'll say, gee, you know, I've worked on this thing 50 times. Why am I not finished with it? Well, remember last week when it came up for you, and what did you do? Oh, I went and had a Coke. Oh, you just did some caffeine, some sugar, and some acid. How do you expect to have the vitality to detox something that deeply impactful unless you have the physiology able to do it? And so my level 7 toxin is not going to show up till I get to a level 7.5 vitality. And that's oftentimes why. And people will become frustrated because they're like, well, gee, I dealt with this issue 5 years ago. Well, yeah, you did. I remember that. You were at about a level 3 vitality, and you got this issue that's a level 9, and you went from a 3 to a 4, so you got to do a piece of work around that, but you haven't touched the 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 stuff yet, and you're not going to see the 9 until you get to a 9.5 vitality. So people tend to spiral around and back to those issues as they build vitality, and the more vital one is, if one opens an issue, the more rapidly physiology is going to be able to dissipate the energy and move through it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So it's delayed. You're not going to be able to release that negative energy if your body can't handle it. Then how do you die?
Well, that's what happens is people end up with, you know, they my offering would be the only reason we die. All death is suicide. You go back into the scriptures and they say, with man, death began. This energy field was designed to be eternal. The only thing that inhibits an integrated energy from staying integrated for eternity is energy is of the energy of its eternal. The only thing that inhibits it from remaining eternal is if you put something in it that doesn't belong in it, that starts to disassemble it, starts to take it apart. So it begins to disintegrate. And death is a result of bringing energetic patterns into this structure that do not fit in or support or not designed for this structure that we call a body-mind unit. And that the word that describes taking that kind of energy into the system, again, in the ancient Aramaic, is the word sin. What do they say? The wages of sin is death. I can remember thinking that was some kind of a theological threat. God's going to get me for my sins. No, that's not what it was. They were just telling you how physiology works. You put enough energy in that doesn't belong. And, you know, I mean, you got a house, beautiful house, great, awesome shape, and you start filling it with cockroaches and mice. And, you know, you drill a few holes in the roof, let some water in that doesn't belong. It's not going to be long before that house dissolves. Because now, if, on the other hand, if you only allow energies in to belong, you keep the air conditioning on, you keep the heat going, you know, and, gee, the house will stand forever. And so each time we engage in an energy that creates deterioration, so if you engage in anything and you notice there's a deterioration of some aspect of the function of your body, then you know that you're engaging in sin. And what's the result of sin? The wages of sin is death. And again, it's about how physiology works. It's not about some kind of threat. It's not, you know, sadly, churchianity has made it, you know, God's going to get you for your sins. No, no. The Creator, the active presence of love that flows throughout the universe in which we live, move, and have our being is the space where everything that doesn't belong can be dissolved in an instant. But creative force gave us free will and said, anything you choose to hold on to, baby, it's yours. You want to bind it on earth, it's yours to bind on earth. You want to let go of it, and you can let go of it. But you can't have it both ways. You can't be a creator and then pretend somebody else is doing it to you. And so what the scripture, as I see it, when I look at it from the brain cells of physics, they were just saying, here's how your physiology works. And we'll tend to build vitality as we engage in more and more of the right energetic patterns, whether they're physical, mental, emotional, relational, you know, nutritional, right down to the breath, right down to the quality of water that we drink. And so the more I engage in what is in harmony with and supports what it is that I'm using. There's an interesting story in the scriptures about the farmer who doesn't observe the laws of the land in terms of growing food. And they talk about, you know, there'll be a man who'll have 10 wives and they'll each bake him a loaf of bread and he's going to starve to death. Why did he starve to death? He had all that bread. His belly was full. Why did he starve to death? Oh, well, they explained just before that, they didn't understand how to keep the fields properly so that the fields yielded wheat that gave the man nutrition. So when they violated the land laws, the man died. Anywhere the energetic laws are violated, if we're not, you know, like something I've really been tapping into since we started gardening here, since we kind of settled here in Virginia. And I've realized that you can't grow food on dirt, that you have to have soil. And most people don't even know there's a difference. But if you go to the big grocery store and you look in the, you know, regularly grown food department, if you went back to the farm that grew the foods, or actually, it maybe shouldn't even be called a farm. It should be called a manufacturing facility. What you'll find is they start out by pouring 10 gallons of glyphosate, a carcinogenic poison, onto the land that kills absolutely everything in the land, makes it totally, completely sterile. And then they plant a seed, and then they sell that same farmer chemicals to put some available nutrient into the soil so that the plant can grow. If there is no life in the soil, the nutrients are not yielded up. The nutrients that the seed needs to grow come from the activity of the microlife in the soil. And if you kill all of that, then you get to sell that farmer chemicals to give it something to grow on, and then you get to sell that farmer, you know, toxic sprays to kill the bugs that are going to come and eat the weak and dying food that comes out, or the so-called food that comes out of the ground, and then it ends up in the grocery store dead. I mean, it's like trying to get life from death. Poor glyphosate kills everything. Now let's grow something alive. I mean, that's just silly on its face. The energy isn't there. And so in each arena, when they told us to be holy, my offering would be, they weren't talking about being down on your knees with your hands folded. They were saying, understand every level of energy that you're engaged in, whether it's nutritional or what you do with your mind, what you do with your emotion, what you do with your spoon, you know, whatever it is, that you understand on all levels what energies are appropriate to give you the highest levels of vitality, and then engage in it. And anything that doesn't, you forgive, you let loose of. There's hate, fear, rage, guilt, pain, trauma, it's a signal that doesn't belong in the human system. It's disintegrative and ultimately is what kills us. So am I willing to face, like for me, and I shared this with you the other day, you know, a long time ago I started to make the request, recognizing that, you know, you and I and everybody we know Everybody in our ancestry over 120 is dead. So we now know by observing that, that the frequency of death, the energetic patterns that will lead us to death are already in our genes. And for me, one of my requests is I ask to be shown every energy of that killed every person in my bloodline who has ever gone before me. I've asked to be shown that and supported in understanding how to work through it, how to remove it from the structure so that I can return to a normal human lifespan, which is eternal. And to me, that's the ultimate outcome of this work. You know, if you listen to Yeshua in Revelations, he talks about this exact principle. He says, to he that overcomes, and what are we talking about overcoming? Overcoming the taste for the attraction to hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, sugar, you know, junk food, what have you. To he that overcomes, he will not taste of the second death. Well, when they talk about the second death, what's the first death? The first death is when we lose awareness that we are designed to be originators of our lives and we are beings created of active present love, designed to work upon this physiological system called a body-mind unit. When we lose awareness of that and we're raised in a culture that knocks the awareness of the presence of love out of us, which we, our culture is expert at that, and then fills our minds with information and we spend our whole lives being run by the information in our minds, we're not actually alive. We're simply automatons running out the programs that are in the structure. But to really truly wake up to who we are and to begin to function in our capacity to originate means we're alive. So that's when they, how they, why they talked about, you know, being reborn. You need to wake up. You need to open to who you are rather than just running on in automaton status. And then if you overcome what's killed everybody in your bloodline, what he said is, will not taste of the second death, will become a pillar, which obviously is a fixture, in the temple, which is what, the body-mind unit, and shall go out no more. In other words, we're going to stop killing ourselves. So with man, death began. What Yeshua showed was a system of working through everything that we've learned to kill ourselves with and to harmonize with those energies that are kosher, kudsha, those that are in alignment, that are designed for humans. I can only, in terms of generational patterns that have created death, I can only reach into a depth that is as, pardon me, I can't reach any deeper depth than the height of aliveness and vitality which I have. And each time I reach a new level of vitality, I'm going to be able to reach a new depth, which means I'm going to go through the next healing crisis. And, you know, I don't know if you remember when, you know, that intensive you were at way back 30 years ago, but it's often quite funny at an intensive because, you know, people get together and, you know, maybe they're doing a summer, a whole summer at Heartland or something. And over that period of time, it'll kind of become a joke because everybody will go, uh-oh, look at Bill. Bill's rocking. He's just hit a new level of vitality. Everybody get ready for the crash that's going to come, for the next healing opportunity he's going to get to throw off what his new level of vitality is going to show him. So it kind of becomes, you know, I mean, everybody, it becomes so obvious. When one reaches that new level of vitality, it's like, okay, so the next layer is going to come. Great. I stand as a space of support for working through it. Instead of what most people want to do when that next level comes up is they unconsciously are driven to go back to whatever they use to keep that energy in abeyance, to keep it out of view. And so, of course, that's where willingness comes in. I'm willing to go through the physical, mental, and emotional symptoms of healing. And am I willing to do it using only that which is kosher, which is appropriate for this human energy system, whether it's the quality of water that I drink, the quality of food that I eat, the quality of thoughts that I think, the creative process I engage in. and the breath that I breathe. Are you breathing?
Yes.
Awesome. Does that all fit for what you're looking for in the way of information?
Yes, it makes total sense for me. I have type 2 diabetes onset. Somebody had it, wrote something on the comment of nature loads the gun, we pull the trigger. I pulled the trigger, and I know it.
Yeah, we loaded the gun. Nature didn't do it.
No, I know.
The mind of man always wants somebody to blame. Excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm tracking you. I was just mentioning that we have a choice in this. So,
yes.
I went to my massage therapist yesterday. Well, I met her yesterday, I should say that. Wonderful person, and we were talking, and her 13-year-old son has type 1 diabetes, and he's on medicine, and she's pursuing every holistic homeopathic path. However, she needs to keep him alive, of course. So my question is,
right,
I know what happened to me, pretty much. What happened to him? Why did that kid get this at 13? He didn't. He wasn't out there drinking Chardonnay.
Yeah. Well, was he born with diabetes?
Yes. Yes, type 1.
Okay. So then what kind of influences came from his parents? What kind of, you know, the energy that tends to associate with diabetes is unresolved grief. That's where the energy that tends to gravitate toward the pancreas and create its dysfunction. So when one doesn't deal with grief, it tends to create a dysfunction in the pancreas. When one resolves their grief, the load is taken off the pancreas tends to go back into action. I don't know if it happened to be, I don't remember which year you were at Heartland, but way back about the time you were there, there was a woman who was, and I know you were only there for a 9-day if I remember correctly, but there was a woman who was on the support team for a full year. And when she first came to Heartland, she was, it actually became kind of, she became sort of the object of a bit of a joke. And that was that if she started to get bitchy, you went and got her food right away because she had a really heavy-duty blood sugar problem. And if she didn't eat and her blood sugar dropped, she became like, you know, the vampire, you know, type of thing. Mm-hmm. And everybody on the support team knew if that starts, get her food in a hurry or you want to get out of the room. And I can remember the day she did a still point session. This was about maybe 3 months into being there. And in the still point session, she got in touch with the fact that the man that she had married, who was the love of her life, was in a car accident and was given tainted blood and got AIDS and died. And when she touched directly into the trauma in her body about that, that whole syndrome just disappeared. She could fast with everybody else. It didn't matter whether she ate or she didn't. That, you know, drop in blood sugar that created a mental change in her just didn't happen anymore. That same year, we actually had a man who had been on insulin since he was a child. And this guy, I forget now exactly, but he was an older gentleman, you know, in his maybe 70s at that point, 60s, 70s. And he dropped his insulin while he was there, after dealing with some grief issues. So you might expect if you're, and you might ask Rukka, so what's the grief I need to deal with to lift this energy off of my pancreas? And I'm willing to look at it. I'm willing to deal with it. And then if it starts to move, make sure you keep on track with doing the right things. You know, remember the questions you ask yourself if I'm in a healing process or a disease process, when I become symptomatic, I ask myself, one, have I been doing more and more of the right things? If the answer is yes, that's check one. This is a healing process. now that I'm symptomatic. Two, just before this happened, I hit a new level of vitality. Oh, yeah, last night, man, I was flying high. I was just, right on top of the world. Great. Three, am I experiencing some old symptoms? And as I start to look at, oh, so I've reached this level of vitality where I can now capture this hidden energy that I haven't been dealing with, and now I'm able to work through it. So then willingness becomes the thing that needs to be applied. And then the fourth thing you do is you make sure that you keep doing the right things. Because oftentimes when people go into it, they're doing the right things. They, everything's in line and bang, that healing process hits. And then they run out and, they junk out. I remember we had a medical doctor who was at Heartland one year. And why he did this, I don't know why. I remember he was in the cabin piece, if you remember which cabin that is, right across from the Heart Center. And rather than go out the front door of the cabin to get in his car to go to town to get a burger, he was in a healing crisis, he literally climbed out the window of his bedroom to go and get in his car, and he went off to town to get some junk food. And it's amazing how driven, and of course once you become conscious of it, you go, oh, well, actually I think I'll stay in willingness and let my need for that go. Instead of using that suppressor, I'm going to just stay with it and let myself feel this fully and let myself process through it. There's a really good video that you might find helpful to watch, anybody who's listening. This conversation is in line with your thinking, or where you're heading with your work. If you look on Amazon, I know over the years I bought a couple of copies of it. It was made several years ago. It was, $5 or $6. It's called May I Be Frank. And it really is a powerful demonstration of what the healing process looks like. And it's a true story. There's a restaurant out your way called the,
Cafe Gratitude.
Cafe Gratitude. And they ask you when you go into Cafe Gratitude, the greeter will greet you and say, what are you grateful for? Or what do you want? There's a question of the day. And this particular day, two of the young people who worked there, one of them was the son of the owner of the restaurant, had this rather rotund New Jersey tough guy Italian come in to the restaurant. And their question was, what are you willing to have in your life? What do you want in your life? And they describe how this guy went into tears, and he's like, I would love to be loved again, but I'm so fat and ugly that nobody could ever love me. And the young man whose dad owns the restaurant, he goes back and says, Dad, whatever the other guy's name is, we want to take this guy on and help him, support him. And they end up making him an offer that if he'll do what they tell him to do, they'll support him through his healing process. And, they sign a contract with him. He signs that he will not eat anything that they don't feed him from Cafe Gratitude. The two guys go into his home or his apartment in his kitchen. They go through all of his cupboards and his refrigerator, and they remove everything that is a drug that, he treats his food, but is really a drug. I mean, they remove the food from his freezer, from his refrigerator, from his cupboards. And there's a particularly poignant scene in it where one of the things he wants to do is clean up the relationship that he had with his former wife, who was his childhood sweetheart that he still dearly cared for. He had too much trauma to stay together. And his daughter, he'd lost relationship with his daughter, and he wanted a relationship back with his daughter. And these two kids, they've gone out and gotten themselves a camera, and they've decided to turn this into a documentary, May I Be Frank. And they're sitting in his living room, the four of them, or the five of them, and they're going back and forth processing things, and these two kids are facilitating, he with his former wife and his daughter. And I don't remember what the issue was, but something his wife says just triggers him into a rage. And you just watch him, he gets, just like unconscious automatic behavior. He gets up off the couch, he walks into the kitchen and opens the refrigerator looking for a drug. And he closes the refrigerator because he remembers there are no drugs left in there. But it shows what kind of things people are going to have to go through. It's a very powerful documentary on this guy's healing process and what we're going to have to go through in order to get out of the world of unconsciousness and really truly become conscious again and function as true human beings. May I be frank? So it's worth spending a few bucks to buy that, or I don't know. It may be, there may be somewhere nowadays where it's online too. You might be able to.
While you were talking, I looked it up on my Apple TV, and it's in there. I'm not sure what program it is, but it's online. So I found it.
Cool.
Sick, depressed, overweight, 50-year-old Frank Ferrante. Yep.
Cool. Oh, he's a fellow countryman. Oh, it's
yeah.
On, if you've got Prime, it's on Prime Video. It's on Freevee with ads. I'm looking at that now. And it's on Prime Video, it looks like. Or maybe it's just Freevee.
Okay. Yeah, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
I might watch it with my wife. We'll see what happens. But anyway, thank you.
Well, it'd be worth looking at because what, you know, you just get a bird's eye view of what this guy has to go through. And he ends up, you know, back in a pretty fit place. And it takes you through the challenges he has in doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'll have space for you guys to watch that.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Well, any other thoughts for you today, sir?
No, that's good. That was my main question.
Awesome. All right, holding space, my friend.
Thank you.
Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye. Well, Miss Jeannie, we're down to about 10 minutes. Any thoughts for you, or do we have anybody else in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room? If you're out there in listener land and you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our calling number is 563-999-3581. Call that number. You're listening to the show. And then if you push 1, that puts you in phone queue to ask a question, and Jeannie will greet you by your number and introduce you.
We're actually down to about 6.5 minutes, so we've got time for a quick question. Somebody press 1.
Not everybody at once, though. Please. Okay, well, if nobody has a question, instead of getting into another topic.
We actually had a hand just go up.
Oh, great.
Believe that is Ann, so welcome, Ann.
Welcome, dear lady. How are you?
Hey, good. So I just caught probably the last 20 minutes of the gentleman you were talking with, but I got the gist of what you were saying. So the one question I have that adds to that when you were talking about the junk food and all the other things that influence us to be thinking into our old patterns and thoughts. So what about sleep? Would it be the same thing? Sleep deprivation would react in our body the same, similar way?
Anything that the structure needs, whether it's nutrition, and you know, you could look at sleep as a nutrient, because if we're deficient in sleep, the structure cannot process energy properly. So avoiding, and I think many people have trouble sleeping or avoid sleep because there are unconscious dynamics that they just are unwilling to look at in their lives.
Right, right. Because I've been noticing that if, like, I can be all, you know, up and on track with just,
right,
you know, all the tools and doing the right things, but then if I wake up and I have not slept well or got enough sleep, then it's like the negative just is there. And it's like as soon as I get up, get my morning drink, and then get some food in me that's, you know, that's healthy, it's almost like I can just feel the energy change. So, okay, that just confirms that's what I was thinking. I guess I just – it was hard to believe that something like that could be so powerful to make a difference.
Oh,
it's not
2,000%. I mean,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, the brain cannot eliminate wastes properly without enough sleep. You know, the brain, and using it as a metaphor, has to take a bowel movement to stay functional. And it takes, there are certain cells in the brain that have to turn their function a certain way in order to create that elimination. And it takes about 7 hours of sleep for the brain to do that, to literally eliminate what doesn't belong. The glial
cells. That's
to
right.
Operate
okay,
properly
so that's
to eliminate.
Right, 7 hours. Yeah, on average. Okay, again, because, yeah, all right. Okay.
And
that
if you're
sense.
Finding that, if you're finding that when you wake up and it takes food to get you on track, then you might start to look at your blood sugar and what's happening with blood sugar. Because you should be able to get up in the morning and, you know, unless you've got a challenge with blood sugar and the pancreas, you shouldn't need to, you know, run and grab food in order to be balanced. So you might take a look at that. Something else, too, that they're recognizing, or at least some medical doctors are calling, I don't know if it's become consensus yet, but they're calling it type 3 diabetes. And type 3 diabetes expresses as things like memory loss, brain dysfunction, Alzheimer's, that sort of thing. And what happens is that what they've discovered is that there's no insulin in the brain. And so the brain cell, in order to get insulin into a cell, you have to have sugar. That's what carries the insulin. Or, pardon me, you have to have insulin to get the sugar into the cell to function as a nutrient that the cell can function on. But if there is no insulin, then the sugar doesn't get into the brain cell and the brain starts to dysfunction. And there is a product, and if you'd like, I'll send you a link to the one that we use. You can buy a 2-pound container of it. I think it's $38 on Amazon. It's called MCT oil powder. And it's short-chain fatty acids that the body can use without any insulin, can use it for fuel. So any kind of sugar difficulties, that MCT oil powder can be helpful in order to keep especially the brain functioning. And throughout the body, the cell can use it without insulin. And so that might be something to start to just supplement. I mean, we use it. We've got we always have a container on the shelf and we put it in our tea or just we use it prophylactically. And where we discovered, I was doing some research when Jeannie's dad had Alzheimer's, quote unquote, and he got to the point where he could hardly play dominoes with us. And we put him on that MCT oil powder and within less than 2 weeks, he was beating us at dominoes again. So
I forgot about that. I remember, now that you're saying that. Okay, yeah. Can she just put it in the notes for today and I can click on it?
Yeah.
It's in there.
Oh, cool. Of course it is. Perfect. Yeah. I'll click on it this time. I found a note about it and then I go, but then I didn't follow up. So there you go. That's the answer to my little note I found. Okay.
There you go.
All the words to it. Okay, perfect. All right, thanks, guys. Blessings.
All right, blessings. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It is an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.